You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers released his response to the state Republican budget today. The short version, yes, but. We'll find out what the governor vetoed and what it means for the state. First, the Women's World Cup is in its final days in France. The competition began in Paris on June 27th with 24 teams in the mix. It ends this Sunday with the final two teams playing for the big prize in Lyon. One team will be the U.S., having beaten England 2-1. The others being decided today. No spoilers for those who may be taping the game, please. In the months leading up to the tournament, concerns about pay inequities and lack of respect for female athletes have come to a head. Supporters and players alike hope that the current exposure will move governing body FIFA and national soccer organizations to treat male and female athletes more equally. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the World Cup? Are you new to watching women's soccer, or are you a longtime fan? Do you think that within a sport, athletes should be paid and treated the same, or at least closer to equal than they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson was in Paris for a couple matches. She's been following the issues of fairness and equity. Judith, thanks for joining us.
Sure. It's funny to be sitting across as the guest.
On the wrong side of the microphone.
The other side.
You were in Paris, Judith, for the opening match between France and South Korea. Just set the stage, the mood for us at this big event.
Sure. It was at Parc des Princes, which is a large stadium on the western side of Paris. It's where the men's team Paris Saint-Germain plays. 45,000 plus people. It was a sellout crowd. It was a great atmosphere, very festive, very positive. Lots and lots of families, lots of little kids. It felt just very safe and comfortable. I'd say for the adults, it was about mixed half and half men and women. And people were really excited, obviously, to see France play since it was in Paris.
In the run-up to the World Cup and during the tournament, there's been a lot of talk about the big pay difference between women's and men's teams here in the U.S. and around the world. A lawsuit from a lot of the players past and present on the women's team. Can you give us an idea of the kind of scale we're talking about here?
Sure. And I'll try not to throw too many numbers out there, but some are necessary to really get the scope of this. So the 2019 Women's World Cup prize money, so whichever team wins on Sunday, the prize is $30 million. That is 7.5%, so less than 10% of the Men's World Cup prize last year. So the prize money gap between men's and women's championship teams is $34 million. And for instance, the members of the U.S. women's team each earned $90,000 in bonuses for reaching the World Cup quarterfinals. But if they had the same structure that the men do, they would have each earned six times that much. So we're talking not a little bit of difference here. We're talking huge gaps.
What are we hearing from women in the game and others looking at these differences?
You know, as you mentioned, the U.S. women have been leading a legal charge against this. In 2016, five U.S. women players filed a discrimination complaint with the Equal Opportunity Commission. And just in March of this year, all 28 members of the U.S. women's national soccer team pool filed a lawsuit for gender discrimination and unequal pay. They have since decided that they will sit down with U.S. Soccer for mediation starting on June 21st they agreed on June 21st to sit down after the World Cup. U.S. Soccer is saying a couple of things. They're saying that there are differences between the men's and women's collective bargaining agreements, and that's part of it. They're also saying that U.S. men's soccer brings in more revenue than the women, so they deserve more pay. But actually, the Wall Street Journal crunched the numbers and found that actually, since 2016, the U.S. women's team have brought in $2 million more than the men. So that doesn't hold a lot of water.
Looking at the Women's World Cup with our own Judith Sears-Poisson. She was there in the early stages of the tournament. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching? Have you been watching? Are you a longtime fan of women's soccer? Are you new to the game? Maybe this year. Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Judith, you talk to people in France, soccer, a big game there, more so per person than here in the United States. You talked with some people on the street in Paris in the first days of the tournament. You talked with a group of sixth graders. How did that come about?
Sure. I was at the Institute of the Arab World, and they had an exhibit on the role of soccer in the Arab world, and there was clearly a sixth grade field trip there. And so I kind of sidled up to them and asked the teacher if I could talk with them. And this is what some of the kids had to say.
On va donner du courage aux filles, mais on peut pas, moi, je préfère les garçons.
So that was a group of boys, sixth grade boys, and they were saying, we're going to be sending our strength and supporting the women. One of them said, I prefer watching the men, and I asked why. And he said, well, we know them better. We can see them on TV. We know their names. We know their careers. They said it's a lot harder because women's soccer isn't publicized as much, but they said it doesn't matter. They're going to be supporting them anyway.
And did you get to talk with other people, maybe some grown-ups, about women's and men's soccer?
I did. So I was in the Luxembourg Gardens, which is a lovely green space in Paris, and I went up to a group of gardeners who were working there and spoke with one of the men.
C'est la médiatisation. Nous, chez nous, c'est médiatisé parce qu'il y a une Coupe du Monde. Mais sinon,
so he was saying that he loves soccer. He watches soccer. He would happily watch women's soccer as much as men's. But he said it's how much media exposure it gets. And he said he was embarrassed to say he didn't know individual players. This is right at the beginning of the tournament. He didn't know individual players because it's just not out there. And he feels that there should be more exposure so that people get to know the women. He said, as far as the play, he thinks they're equally strong and equally interesting.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Logan on the line in Green Bay. Logan, hi.
Hi. So I just want to express my disdain for the treatment of women. And I cannot understand, I cannot comprehend why men earn more.
Logan, worried about the pay gap, Judith, a common refrain we're hearing lately.
Right. And, you know, I think it has been weighing on the women. The motto of the tournament is Le Moment de Briller, or Dare to Shine in English. And, you know, I think hearing some of the interviews with players, seeing what they've shared on social media, they really feel a lot of pressure to make their case by playing really well. And, you know, this is a high pressure thing already. It's sad that they have to kind of take on that extra mantle, I think.
Thanks for that call, Logan. We'll go to Lance now in Superior. Lance, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Lance?
Well, I guess my concern is that I believe in equal pay for equal skill, regardless of gender. But right now, I think athletes are all overpaid. I mean, I don't take my kids to baseball games anymore or football games anymore because plainly it's just too expensive. I just wonder what your guest thinks about that.
Lance, thanks a lot for the call. And there's concern for men's soccer worldwide about what people see as a corrupting influence of too much money at all levels of the game.
Right. And that's an interesting point about maybe reducing men's salaries is the answer, because in Norway, that's actually the approach that they took. The men took a pay cut. The men lost just a couple percentage points of their annual salary for playing soccer, whereas it actually doubled the women's. But the Norwegian soccer fans know that one of the greatest women players of the time, she's only 23 and she's already thought to be one of the best players, Ada Hegerberg. She's actually not playing in the World Cup on the Norwegian national team because she said it's not just equal pay. It's that equal exposure. It's that equal respect that we heard from, you know, some of the fans in Paris that, you know, pay is one thing, but it's not everything.
Is there a sense that things might be changing, Judith? That we saw numbers today. It looks like the U.S. women's national team home jersey, correct me if I have this wrong, is the all-time best-selling soccer jersey in United States history. Any soccer, men's,
exactly.
Women's, pro.
It's for a season, it's the best seller, the U.S. women's soccer jersey. And I will say, and this was actually a comment on the Twitter feed, it was almost impossible to find them until a couple weeks before. I did every possible Google search. And whenever you put in women's and soccer, it would actually pop up jerseys from last year's men's World Cup in a women's size. So given that it wasn't even that easy to find those jerseys and that it's the best seller for Nike ever is pretty amazing. I think that I actually spoke to a young 19-year-old woman who was playing a game of pickup soccer with some friends. And she said, you know, we're seeing a big increase in interest right now. She was a little skeptical that it's going to last, but I think definitely women's soccer is on the minds of viewers and spectators and fans in a way it hasn't been before.
As we wrap up, Judith, I mentioned not spoiling today's game for those taping it. I know a certain Central Time executive producer who's been taping daytime weekday
I have
games.
I have been. I am staying in the bubble. I managed to stay in the bubble for the U.S. Game yesterday, and I'm hoping to stay there today.
Judith, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
That's Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson. She was in France for the start of the Women's World Cup and has been following issues of inequities between women's and men's teams, their pay, respect, and coverage. Coming up, Governor Evers tackled the Republican-approved state budget. He signed it, but with lots of changes, using his partial veto power. We'll get the details coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump will host a 4th of July celebration in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. We'll look at what's new about the event and why some members of Congress aren't happy with the plans. First, state Republicans passed their two-year budget plan for Wisconsin last week. The bill went to Governor Evers. His options: sign the budget as is, veto the whole thing, or sign it but make use of the powerful line item veto power that Wisconsin governors get to use. He released his answer this morning. The budget got his signature with lots of partial vetoes. Laurel White joins us to sort things out. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we get to the changes, how much can a Wisconsin governor do with this partial veto power?
So the Wisconsin governor actually has quite a bit of power, especially in terms of the powers of other governors across the country. They have the partial veto power. So what he can do with the state budget, and what he did, consequently, is take out certain words, certain numbers, and punctuation to change the document a little bit to fit kind of more of his goals and priorities.
And we didn't get to see this in action as much. Governor Walker had a Republican majority, you know, all Republicans. He did use the partial veto. Wasn't as big a deal. When we had Republican Governor Tommy Thompson in Democratic state legislature, it got wild and wacky sometimes. Mm-hmm. In the scope of things, how big are the changes we saw that Governor, and how many of these changes are there that Governor Evers made with this power?
So the scope of the changes I'll get to in a second, because I think it's sort of a eye of the beholder situation. But in terms of numbers, he issued 78 partial vetoes. I think it's safe to say that the biggest one is a veto that increases state school spending by about $65 million over the course of the next 2 years. He did that by increasing per pupil aid in Wisconsin quite a bit, using that fancy veto authority.
It seems a little weird that you can add spending by cutting words, mm-hmm. but that's how it works, or it can work.
Absolutely. It's a complicated thing, because essentially you have to, if you're adding in funding for something using this veto authority, you have to find that money elsewhere in the budget as it exists. So in order for the governor to add that $65 million for public schools in Wisconsin, he had to find that money elsewhere in the budget. There are a couple different places, but I think the most interesting to folks is probably that he cut some state funding for enforcing work requirements that Republicans passed under Governor Walker for public benefits like food stamps.
Education had been kind of the big point of contention between the governor and lawmakers. The governor wanted to increase it by a lot. Republican lawmakers in their budget, if I have this right, did increase it, but by a substantially smaller amount. So how did we end up when it comes to those two original numbers?
So what Governor Evers initially proposed early this year was a $1.4 billion increase for K-12 education in Wisconsin. What Republican lawmakers approved last week was a $500 million increase. So, you know, about a third of what Governor Evers asked for. And then today, with his veto pen, the governor added in about, as I said, $65 million. So we're at $565, $570 million in an increase for K-12 schools. Still falls pretty far short of that $1.4 billion he wanted.
When it comes to changes in the amount of money being spent in the state, was this one, the education change, the biggest that we saw from among these dozens of partial vetoes?
I think it's the biggest one in terms of changes that Evers made to the document. There are a couple other high-profile changes. Folks might remember us talking about some legislation and then a provision that was included in the budget that would have allowed direct-to-consumer sales of Tesla vehicles in Wisconsin. That was something that was added kind of at the last minute. And some people thought that was aimed at getting a Republican holdout in the Senate to vote for the budget. Senator Chris Cappinga from Delafield, he's pushed for that change for a while. The governor nixed that from the budget. He also nixed a spending limit for security for his lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes. Republicans included that cap to make sure that Barnes didn't spend any more than the previous lieutenant governor after some reports that he'd been spending more.
Before we get into more specifics from the line item vetoes, what, if anything, can Republicans do about this if they don't like particular vetoes?
So Republicans can override a veto in Wisconsin, but to do that, they need a three-quarters vote of the state legislature, both chambers of the legislature. And though they have large majorities, particularly in the assembly, they don't have what's required to override a veto.
And in the Senate, they have well short of that three-quarters.
Exactly, yes.
So that's probably not going to happen unless Democrats agree with them on a particular veto.
Exactly. Democrats would have to agree to override something that the governor did, which would be very unlikely.
So, again, before we get into more details, as it stands, this partially vetoed budget, it's it. This is the budget now.
That's right. This is the budget. So, you know, barring any veto overrides, which, again, would be very unlikely, this is the budget that we're going to be operating on in the state of Wisconsin through 2021.
And let's get into what both sides are saying today. What did Governor Evers, what kind of case did he make for why he made the changes he did?
So he said that he believed his veto messages sort of encapsulated a spirit of cooperation in the Capitol. He said that he actually strongly considered vetoing the entire budget, which is something folks had talked a lot about over the past, you know, 5-6 days, because it didn't increase education spending as much as he wanted, didn't have that Medicaid expansion that he's talked so much about. But he said that ultimately vetoing the budget would have led to more political discord, sort of partisan fighting. And when he spoke to a group at the Capitol today, he said, you know, that's the sort of politics that Wisconsin residents are tired of. That's not the kind of thing that I want to engage in. So I'm going to sign this budget that has some Republican priorities, that doesn't have everything I want, in the spirit of compromise.
And we'd heard, I think it was from Robin Voss, who said, the assembly speaker, who said, OK, if the governor vetoes the whole shebang, that's fine. We're not going to pick it up again until, I think he said, October at one point.
That's
so
right.
So we would have had a bunch of months of real, probably angry arguments going back and forth.
Oh, absolutely. And I think something that different stakeholders pointed out as that possibility was raised was that it could cause problems for state agencies not having a budget. It could cause particularly big problems for schools in Wisconsin because they'd be starting the school year without certainty over what budget lawmakers were going to approve, exactly how much money they were going to get, whether they were going to get an increase or not. So I think that was kind of a looming scary possibility that budget negotiations could go toward the end of this year.
Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about Governor Evers' signature on the Republican state budget with partial vetoes, some key vetoes along the way. What have we heard so far? I know this is the ink is still fresh, but what have we heard from Republican leaders on this?
So Republican leaders, interestingly, are pretty happy. I think they're characterizing this budget as one that includes a lot of their priorities. They're saying that Governor Evers' vetoes were minimal. That's what Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said after the governor's signing. He said, you know, this is really a Republican budget and we feel good about it.
And we've heard arguments, I think, from Democrats who said, well, hold on, what Republicans came up with was heavily inspired by what Governor Evers said. They said, so both sides saying, hey, the other side met us, if not halfway, a third of the way.
Exactly. I think that that's a really fair summary, because Republicans are saying, you know, a lot of our priorities are in this budget, while Democrats are saying, hey, the things that Governor Evers proposed earlier this year sort of helped move the needle in terms of what Republicans approved, the amount of money that they had, and the sort of things they invested in.
So we've mentioned education funding and the partial vetoes, those work requirements you mentioned for public benefits, those direct-to-consumer Tesla sales. Prison funding is an issue we've been watching as this process has gone along. Did we see big changes made by the governor today?
So I think one interesting thing to note is the governor eliminated an earmark that was for a new maximum security prison in Green Bay. He took out $5 million, which in the scheme of the budget is not very much, but that was intended to buy land on which to build this new maximum security prison in Green Bay. So the governor took out sort of the requirement of where that money would be spent. He still gave the money to DOC, but said it didn't need to go there, and said that there needed to be a little bit more sort of examination of the state's practices in that area before they made that kind of choice.
Another often contentious item in the state budget is road and transportation funding. We saw some agreement from the governor and from Republicans that they needed to get more money somewhere. Anything of interest in the vetoes today?
So there was a fair amount of compromise there in the end. The governor wanted to, of course, increase the gas tax, which Republicans didn't get on board with. But they did end up approving these vehicle title and registration fees, which is something that the governor had also proposed, just not quite to the scale that Republicans ended up approving in the budget. The governor did actually make a small change to those title and registration fees to come up with about $7 million to kind of help pad that $65 million that he put into schools. And he did that by changing the registration fee for particularly heavy vehicles, ones that weigh over 6,000 pounds in Wisconsin. Under the Republican plan, the fees actually would have gone down a little bit for those. So he made sure that they stayed where they are.
Anything else that struck you as significant based on all the things we've been talking about over the last months in this process, Laurel?
Well, I think of other things that sort of stuck out to me, the governor did veto a $2.5 million study that would have looked at a potential mileage-based fee or tolling in Wisconsin as a way to pay for roads. That's something that was added to the budget or kind of clarified in the budget kind of toward the end. He said we don't need another study to come up with a way to fund roads in Wisconsin. And then he also made some changes related to local regulation of quarries in the state. This is something that we've done some coverage on at WPR. Under the Republican-backed budget, there would have been a limitation on how much local governments can regulate kind of operating hours and things for quarries. The governor took that provision out of the budget as well.
So we have this budget. The battle isn't going late into the summer or the fall, as it sometimes does. What do lawmakers do now?
Well, lawmakers are leaving the Capitol for now, and we're not expecting them to come back until the fall. So sort of now the focus turns to what implementation of this budget looks like, a kind of a deeper examination of that, and looking forward to what they plan to do in the fall. Some of the things on our radar include a potential reintroduction of a medical marijuana proposal. That's something Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he might be interested in taking a look at. Also, nonpartisan redistricting legislation. That's something that the governor talked about today as he addressed the crowd with his veto message. He said, I'm going to make that a big priority. He also said he's going to reintroduce that Medicaid expansion as separate legislation. Now, obviously, that faces a very, very steep climb in the legislature. But I think for folks looking to see these issues completely go away, now that we're not talking about them as part of the state budget, that definitely not the case. These things are sticking around.
Laurel, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, with us for a look at the governor's partial vetoes of the state budget. Coming up after the news, a 4th of July event in the nation's capital tomorrow is scheduled to include fighter jets, tanks, and military leaders. We'll find out about the reaction it's getting in Washington and ask what you think. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about President Trump's historic steps into North Korea over the weekend and what that gesture means for negotiations over the country's nuclear program. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. A House committee is suing the IRS and Treasury Department to obtain President Trump's tax returns. There's been more congressional reaction to poor conditions at migrant detention facilities near the southern border. And the president is planning a new 4th of July celebration for the nation's capital, one that'll feature tanks, fighter jets, and military bands. Our question for you this week, what do you think of this expanded 4th of July festivities with the president participating? Is it a good idea? Do you have concerns about the cost or the possible partisan nature of the celebration? Or do you think it sends a good message? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Morrow is a U.S. correspondent for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
The House Ways and Means Committee, Adrian, sued the heads of the Treasury Department and the IRS this week. They're trying to get President Trump's tax returns after a subpoena earlier. What is the committee saying about its right to see those returns from the president?
It basically says that, you know, the committee has the right to look at these as part of its sort of you know, a broader investigation. And the kind of narrow, you know, I mean, obviously the reason they're looking into this is because they think that there might be some, you know, some matter of public interest in the tax returns themselves. But I think that the sort of legal rationale that they're using is that it's germane to an investigation of kind of how, you know, how presidential how the tax system is handled and how these sorts of things sort of, you know, work administratively. And so they're essentially arguing that, you know, they're doing their sort of proper exercising Congress's kind of proper oversight function, you know, by looking at these documents and kind of, you know, making sure that that the IRS and Treasury Department are kind of, you know, properly handling taxes.
And they're citing rules and regulations that allow this particular committee to look at any American citizen's tax returns. It doesn't cite exceptions in that rule. What is the argument from the White House and the Treasury Department about why they're not providing that?
Yeah, I mean, they essentially say that they don't have to, you know, that this isn't sort of, you know, necessary for the committee to do its job. And that, you know, essentially saying if the committee just wants to sort of look at policy issues around taxes or sort of how taxes are being handled, you know, they don't need the president's tax returns, you know, specifically to do that.
But Congress, at least House Democrats, I should say, are citing Congress's oversight role, right, of the executive branch. They're saying this is part of their job. Is that their counter argument?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, they're basically arguing that they have the, you know, Congress has the right to exercise oversight on, you know, on the executive branch, whether it's the president or, you know, the Treasury Department or the IRS, and that this is sort of just part of that, that they should be able to get the document.
Now, turning to the U.S. Census, Adrian, last week the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the Trump administration's reasoning for adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census. They didn't shoot it down completely, though. But now we're hearing some different things from the administration. I think we have the Justice Department and Commerce Department, right, saying, nope, the question is off. But the president tweeting, hold on, it's not. What are we hearing from all parties at the White House?
Yeah, I mean, this is just the usual sort of disorganization of the Trump administration, where, you know, his administration is kind of, you know, running things the way that a normal administration would, right? Where they, you know, they said they want to put this question on the census. You know, the Supreme Court has ruled against them, and so they basically made a decision within the Commerce Department that, you know, there's no way that they could realistically, you know, fight this or sort of try to get this, you know, approved for the census, you know, or sort of win a court battle over it in time for them to actually print the census questionnaire. And so Commerce has sort of made the, you know, the fairly pragmatic decision that, okay, you know what, we won't put this on the 2020 census because it's just not practical to try to get that, you know, get all the sort of legal, you know, legal restrictions sorted out before then. You know, so they said that yesterday, but then the president came out and said, you know, completely contradicted them and said, no, actually, that question will be on the census. But I mean, he hasn't cited sort of any real sort of way that could happen, you know, because he hasn't explained, you know, exactly sort of how they would sort out all the kind of legal complications before that. You know, especially given that his own government is saying, you know, that they won't have time to kind of work through the legalities, you know, before they have to print the census. You know, I suppose there's maybe theoretically some way that they could try to get the, you know, if they get the legality sorted out in their favor, they could maybe try to include it on a digital version of the census, but not on the paper version. But that seems, you know, to me, that seems very, that seems like that'd be a very dodgy thing to do, because, you know, you generally want to have the same questionnaire, whether it's digital or in hard copy, to make sure that your results are consistent sort of across the entire census. So, you know, I mean, my guess would be at some point the president, you know, probably will have to sort of give this up or just forget about it, because, you know, at the end of the day, the Commerce Department is probably correct that they just don't have the time, even if they did, you know, even if they did sort of go back to the Supreme Court and win this one, they wouldn't have the time to do that before they have to actually print the census questionnaires.
It's the Week in Washington. Adrian Morrow is with us from the Globe and Mail. We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We'll have more on that census issue tomorrow on the show after 4. The census, the issue of citizenship, and what recourse, if any, the president has with the deadline ticking, the clock ticking. That's tomorrow after 4. Adrian, this week we've seen Democratic lawmakers talking a lot this week about conditions at migrant detention facilities near the U.S.-Mexico border. We talked about their visit some on the show yesterday. What reactions in Congress are catching your eye right now?
I mean, I think just the way that the Congress has kind of highlighted, you know, sort of how bad the detention conditions are, you know, and the fact that, you know, you even whatever you sort of feel, however you feel about sort of President Trump's argument on immigration one way or the other, you know, whether you feel that, you know, yes, all these people sort of crossing the border, you know, need to be kind of immediately detained and should be held in custody until they're, you know, until they can have a hearing, or whether you feel that the people should be, you know, should be sort of allowed to go out and work, whether it's in the U.S. or Mexico, you know, while their claims are being adjudicated. You know, however you sort of feel about the overall policy argument, you know, the conditions of the detention centers that the Congress kind of highlighted, and that, you know, the sort of internal federal government report that came out late yesterday, I think sort of confirmed, is that the conditions there are just are just sort of inhumane in a developed country. People sort of crammed in these relatively small areas, sort of having to stand up for long periods of time. People sort of not being, they're not getting sort of food or water at the right, the right amounts of time. It really sort of looks, it looks really bad on the administration, just sort of the fact that, basically the upshot of Trump's, Trump's policy and sort of encouraging more detentions, but not, the fact that, that the U.S. government hasn't sort of adequately funded the detention centers to actually hold all these people. It's really, it's really kind of, you're really seeing it in a very visceral way.
Congress passed this little over $4.5 billion bill of aid last week. Some of that is supposed to go to these facilities. What do we know about what of that money is going to go to address these particular issues you just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of been the Democrats, I think, imperative in Congress is attempting to, to at least sort of properly resource the border so that there's, so that there is sort of more, more sort of money for these facilities. But, you had a situation about a year ago where they were talking about sort of opening up military bases to house people. So I think that kind of gives you an idea of the scale of the issue. And, it's possible that the money they're allocating is going to expand the detention facilities enough that it will, be able to sort of absorb the number of people that that the administration wants. But, I think if Trump sort of had his way, I think they'd be detaining even more people at the border and sort of letting, letting fewer people go. So, I think it's sort of an open question at this point whether even the new money that they have allocated is going to be enough to expand the detention facilities, to the extent that would be necessary.
Let's turn now, Adrian, to this July 4th event tomorrow. President Trump planning what he's calling a salute to America in D.C. Here's a listen to the president talking about what to expect.
We're going to have a great 4th of July in Washington, D.C. It'll be like no other. It'll be special. And I hope a lot of people come. And it's going to be about this country. And it's a salute to America. And I'm going to be here and I'm going to say a few words. And we're going to have planes going overhead, the best fighter jets in the world and other planes, too. And we're going to have some tanks stationed outside.
How does this compare to the usual Washington, D.C. July 4th celebration, Adrian?
Yeah, so it's sort of unusual in a couple of ways. I mean, number one is that typically the president doesn't actually sort of host the 4th of July celebrations in Washington. And I think sort of the reason for that is there's this idea that it shouldn't, there shouldn't be sort of the possibility of partisan politics kind of, impeding the celebrations. And so typically the president doesn't get directly involved in the big celebration on the mall. And then the second aspect is actually the military element where, there have been, military parades in Washington in the past. But typically it's not sort of part of the Independence Day celebration. Like, typically the Independence Day on the Mall is generally this very sort of apolitical event with fireworks, a concert, some picnicking and that sort of thing. And it's relatively, I guess relatively apolitical and sort of relatively sedate. So it's a little bit unusual for Trump for a sitting president to basically say that, he's going to sort of take ownership of the celebrations and give a speech. And it's also unusual for him to say we're going to sort of, use some military hardware, as part of our Independence Day celebration.
We're inviting our callers to weigh in on this July 4th celebration at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Matt now calling in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. First of all, the concern is Donald Trump hijacking the event to turn it into a partisan event. But moreover, I think what's most disconcerting is, Donald Trump has bypassed Congress with executive orders. He's befriended autocrats and dictators the world over. And he's also hinted at eliminating term limits for the president. He's mentioned that probably four or five times. And so it's all very disconcerting because it smacks of an autocrat.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Adrian, he's raising two different concerns there that people have brought up. We'll get to the visuals and what that means. But first of all, the idea of it being politicized, I think some Democrats saying, hey, the Republican National Committee is handing out some of the best seats at this thing. What have we heard on that front, Adrian?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the main sort of concern on the politicization front at this point, too, is that he's decided there's going to be a VIP area sort of in front of where he gives the speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And so, it does seem a bit, and the fact that, that they've had the Republican National Committee has been allocating some of the seats and that sort of supporters of Donald Trump will get sort of better seating at the event, that in and of itself kind of looks like politicization. And I think there's also a question sort of what Trump is going to say, because it is entirely possible he might go up tomorrow and sort of give a very, kind of benign speech about American patriotism and how important America is in the world. But there's also the possibility that Trump being Trump, he'll go up and deliver a broadside against his political opponents. So I think there's a lot of sort of possibility for this to become, for this to become very politicized. And on the optics front, I think it's sort of interesting because, Trump's sort of inspiration for doing this, for bringing in the military, actually comes from France. And, he went to a Bastille Day celebration a couple of summers ago, and I guess was deeply impressed by the way that the French, it is true that the French do have a massive military component in their Bastille Day celebrations. They have, tanks in the streets, cuirassiers, guys in these sort of old, Napoleonic, cavalry outfits that are riding down the Champs-Élysées. And so that apparently impressed Trump, and that's kind of what he's patterning the Independence Day celebrations on. But the problem is that most people are probably not going to be familiar with that. And I think most people, when they see tanks in the streets or they see, a military component to your National Day celebrations, probably immediately think of autocracies and particularly the former Soviet Union. That was sort of always a big component of Red Square, on the 1st of October. And so I think that's sort of the real sort of optical danger that Trump kind of runs into, is that a lot of people kind of see him flanked by tanks giving a speech on Independence Day and immediately sort of think of autocratic governments.
Talking to Adrian Morrow of the Globe and Mail right now about some of the top political news stories of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Still want to hear your thoughts on this 4th of July celebration in the nation's capital. Do you think things like fighter jets and tanks have a place for flyovers or to be on display? Do you worry about the cost or partisan nature? Or do you like a big to-do for the 4th of July? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, talking about this week's news in national politics. Invited your calls on this celebration planned by the president in Washington, D.C. for tomorrow, Independence Day. Your thoughts on it at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Deb is with us in Milwaukee. Deb, hi.
My call. I agree with everything that your third caller said, all of his concerns, but another concern, and I'm also afraid to answer this, but the thing with the homelessness rate is costly.
Deb, thanks for the call. Concerns have been raised, Adrian, about the cost of the festivities. What do we know?
Yeah, so far everyone has actually been sort of sketchy and hasn't quite sort of won't disclose exactly how much the facilities are going to cost. I've asked the Park Service today and they refuse to say. But what we do know is that it typically costs about $2 million to do the festivities on the mall, and there has been some sources have told various reporters that it could be sort of $2 million more on top of that or even more than that. That is going to have to be diverted to pay for it. So some of that might come from the National Park Service, which typically runs these sorts of events. But a lot of the costs will actually just be from the military and having to transport a bunch of their gear and fly a bunch of the planes up to D.C. As well as sort of pay their staff to be there. So so it's not entirely clear how much more it's going to cost. But yeah, I mean it's very likely to be within the millions of dollars. Flying all those fighter jets alone costs quite a lot of money when you think of the amount of the sort of fuel expenses that sort of go into it. So it is going to cost, definitely going to cost more money for the, either the military or the Park Service to stage this.
Deb, thanks for the call. We'll go to Adam now in Soldiers Grove. Adam, hi.
Hi. My biggest concern, and actually this goes on with her, where it comes down to the Democrats are now complaining about the cost, but they have no issue spending, millions of dollars on, the Russian issue, and now they're spending millions of dollars on taking care or trying to get his taxes. That I don't understand that. Why can he spend money on that but not on the patronage and being a patriot? I don't understand that.
Adam, thanks for the call. And that's the argument. Maybe it's worth spending some money to honor the military and American history, Adrian.
Yeah, I was talking to Trump supporters down on the mall today. We're sort of watching them wheeling the tanks in by the Lincoln Memorial, and a bunch of them said, you have to show America's adversaries that we've got lots of military hardware if you want them not to mess with us. So there's certainly a constituency for there is a large constituency for what Trump is doing. I think there are a lot of people who are fine with them spending the money to sort of show off America's military hardware and kind of send this message, don't mess with us, I guess. So yeah, certainly, I mean people who support Trump, I think are, at least the ones I've spoken to, are certainly supportive of him doing this event, spending the money and adding a military component to it.
And Adrian, you've been out talking to to people, I understand, in weather that's knocking on the door of 100 degrees. Do you know what the weather's supposed to be like for the actual event tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, tomorrow is supposed to be a little bit like today, so it'll probably be blazingly hot and humid, you know, during most of the day tomorrow. But there is a call for thunder showers in the forecast tomorrow evening, so it's possible that by the time, you know, the actual program gets underway and Trump gets up to speak, that that the city might be drenched. So I think everybody tomorrow is sort of hoping that that's not the case and that the weather changes. But at the moment, the forecast actually doesn't look so good. It could very well be, you know, could very well be the event gets you know, fully or partially rained out.
Talking to Adrian Morrow from the Globe and Mail, looking at some of the top stories in the week in Washington. I want to move on to something you've been reporting on, Adrian. President Trump told Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that he would talk with Chinese President Xi Jinping about Canadian detainees, two of them. Give us the backstory there, please.
Yeah, so you know, back in December, Canadian authorities arrested Meng Wanzhou, who's the CFO of Huawei, which is a big Chinese telecommunications and mobile phone company. And they arrested her on behalf of the FBI, because the FBI has basically been building a case for years that Ms. Wanzhou you know, tried to orchestrate a bunch of actions that would have broken U.S. sanctions on Iran. And so you know, so the FBI had this warrant out for her. They basically referred it to the Canadians, and the Canadians arrested her in Vancouver when she was there you know, changing planes for a flight. So subsequent to that, China basically detained these two Canadians. One is a former diplomat and one's an entrepreneur. And they basically held them on these what would appear to be trumped up charges of, you know, claiming that these guys were, you know, might have been engaging in espionage or that sort of thing. But very clearly seems to just be, you know, revenge on China's part for Canada, you know, serving this U.S. arrest warrant on Meng Wanzhou. And on top of that, you know, what China's also done is they've imposed some trade sanctions on Canada, on Canadian beef and pork and canola and some other, you know, some other agricultural commodities to try to sort of put some economic pressure on Canada as well. And so, you know, what happened a couple of weeks ago when Justin Trudeau was in Washington, he's basically been telling, you know, and the Canadians have been telling the Americans this for quite a long time. And I think Trudeau, you know, said this to Trump at his meeting. He said, you know, we did this for you. We stood by our extradition treaty and arrested, you know, somebody on behalf of the FBI. Now our people are basically getting hurt over it. So, you know, can you help us? You know, can you sort of, you know, basically have our back like we had yours? You know, and when you see Xi Jinping at the G20 in Osaka, you know, raise this with him and basically tell him that he has to, you know, let these guys go and stop, you know, stop imprisoning Canadians as punishment. And so, you know, Trump actually made a commitment, you know, on camera in a scrum with reporters in the Oval Office, where he said, yes, you know, if Justin Trudeau wants me to go, you know, raise this issue with Xi Jinping, you know, I will do that. And I think he said something like anything I can do to help Canada, I will do. And so there have been some questions this weekend, you know, over at the summit, you know, whether Trump actually did that, because, you know, Trump wasn't asked about it in his news conference. Trudeau was asked about it, but Trudeau basically said, you know, I think, you know, I assume that he did, but you have to ask him. And so for several days, you know, nobody would say, and I asked the White House, you know, earlier this week, you know, did that happen? Did Trump sort of stick true to his word? And nobody would tell me on either side. Just within the last hour or so, I've had a couple of sources on the Canadian side who said that they've heard from the Americans that, yes, Trump did, in fact, you know, raise the issue of the detained Canadians with Xi Jinping. The Americans apparently said that he raised it forcefully, quote unquote. But it's not clear at this point sort of what that means, you know, whether he actually laid out any sort of, you know, consequences for Xi Jinping if he doesn't release the Canadians, or whether he just sort of mentioned it in passing. But what we do know is that the Trump, you know, did sort of, you know, keep his promise to Trudeau and apparently did raise, according to the Americans, did raise this issue directly with the Chinese president.
And finally and briefly, Adrian, Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, got a lot of attention for playing a noticeable role at this big G20 summit in prominent places and prominent meetings. What do we know about her role there?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really clear that she was, you know, doing a whole lot that was substantive, but she, you know, she, yeah, would sit in for high rank, you know, in place of high ranking U.S. diplomats in meetings of the G20. There was a video that was tweeted by the president of France's office that showed her, you know, sort of trying to get into a conversation with the president of France and Justin Trudeau and the head of the IMF. And we know that her and Jared Kushner followed Trump into his meeting with Kim Jong-un, you know, the North Korean dictator, at the demilitarized zone, and apparently actually met Kim Jong-un sort of alongside, you know, Donald Trump. So he's certainly been, you know, Trump has really made a point of kind of bringing, you know, Ivanka, who, you know, is pretty much his favorite, is, you know, generally believed to be his favorite child, has made a point of kind of having her kind of sit with him and engage in these meetings. But it's not clear if she's actually done anything substantive or if this is more sort of just, you know, I guess her sort of, you know, playing host or kind of job shattering her father.
And just briefly, what kind of reaction has that gotten?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't gotten very positive reaction. I mean, you know, the idea that basically a president has sort of had his you know, his child kind of come and take part in these kind of meetings when it's not clear that there's any sort of, you know, any reason for her to be there. You know, hasn't sort of gone over very well. And it does sort of seem to play into the notion, though, that Trump has kind of given large, you know, hefty portfolios to people in his family. You know, I mean, Ivanka's husband, Jared Kushner, for instance, is sort of in charge of Trump's Mideast peace plan. And it's not really clear that somebody like him, you know, a financier, really has the sort of skill set, you know, necessary to untangle this thing. So this sort of looks like just another kind of another chapter in the, you know, sort of Trump, you know, helping out his family when there might be more qualified people for the job file.
Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent with The Globe and Mail. He was with us for a weekly look at the top news in national politics, joined us from the steamy streets of Washington, D.C. today, where he's getting reaction to this planned 4th of July celebration tomorrow. You can still let us know your thoughts on that. Email ideas@WPR.org or send us a quick note in Twitter form. You can always tweet us. We are at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. If you are of a certain age, the phrase TGIF may take you back to your own personal golden age of TV watching, with a Friday lineup including shows like Family Matters, Perfect Strangers, Step by Step, and Hangin' with Mr. Cooper. That era may make a comeback. Warner Media is reportedly looking at creating reboots of some or all of those shows as part of their streaming service. It's not a done deal. Producer Tim Peterson has thoughts. Hey, Tim.
Hi there, Rob.
So these shows were part of your life, right?
I am, as you say, of a certain age.
Uh-huh. And so which of those shows, looking back to the 90s, were, you know, must-see TV for you?
You know, for me, it was Family Matters. It kicked off a lot of TGIF Friday nights. And, you know, thinking back, seeing an African-American family primetime television really stood out to me.
And that's the show that had Urkel on it, right? Not originally. It kind of veered into Urkel territory as the time went on.
It did. And, you know, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole today and learned that, and in fact, it was a spinoff. Family Matters was a spinoff from Perfect Stranger.
Really? And that's the show with Balky, right?
With Balky, that's
right. If I'm remembering this right.
That, yeah. that Harriet Winslow was actually the elevator woman from the newspaper in Chicago, where the main character from Perfect Strangers
worked. That's mind-blowing. This is like as big as like Mork and Mindy being a Happy Days spin-off.
It is, and there's so many different crossover things from TGIF with Urkel landing spaceships in different shows. We could go on and on about it.
All right, we'll have to get that streaming TV up in our offices if this happens. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome, Rob. Thank you.
This is Central Time.